Chapter 26. The following morning, a black-haired woman drove a smart-looking buggy pulled by a dappled gray horse on the road into Telluride. The road led from the ranching community of Montrose, a rail terminus for the Rio Grande Southern Railroad. She had arrived from Denver and rented the rig and horse at the local stable. She was dressed in a long buckskin skirt over a pair of pointed-toe leather boots. Her upper torso was covered by a nicely knit green sweater under a wolfskin fur coat. A ladies'-style flat-topped cowboy hat was set squarely on her head. She was fashionably attired for the West, but not ostentatious. She came onto Colorado Avenue, past the San Miguel County Courthouse, and pulled the horse to a stop in front of the town stable. She climbed down from the buggy and tied the horse to a hitching post. The stable owner came out and lifted his hat.
"Good afternoon, ma'am. Can I help you?"
"Yes. I wonder if you would please feed and water my horse. I have to be on the road back to Montrose this afternoon."
"Yes, ma'am," said the stable owner politely, slightly taken aback by a voice that had a gentle harshness about it. "I'll take care of it. While I'm at it, I'll tighten your front wheels. They look a mite loose."
"You're very kind, thank you. Oh, and by the way, my sister will come for the buggy and pay you."
"Yes, ma'am."
The woman left the stable and walked a block to the New Sheridan Hotel. She approached the desk clerk and asked, "Do you have a Miss Rachel Jordan registered here?" The clerk shook his head, stared at what he saw as an attractive woman, and said, "No, ma'am, she checked out last night." He paused, turned, and pulled an envelope out of a mail and key slot. "But she said if someone asked for her to give them this." The woman thanked the clerk, walked out onto the sidewalk, opened the envelope, and read the note. She stuffed it in her purse and began walking through town. After a short hike, she came to the Lone Tree Cemetery on a hill north of the San Miguel River. She passed through the gate and walked among the tombstones, noting that most of the deceased had died from mine accidents, snow slides, and miners' consumption. A pretty blonde woman was sitting on a bench beside a gravesite, leaning back and sunning herself. Out of the corner of one eye, she caught the approach of another woman. She sat up and stared at the intruder, who stopped and looked down at her. Margaret began to laugh.
"My God, Jacob," she finally gasped. "That's the most ingenious disguise you've ever created."
Cromwell smiled. "I thought you'd approve."
"A good thing you're short, thin, and wiry."
"I don't know why I never thought of it before." He awkwardly bunched up his buckskin skirt and sat down on the bench next to Margaret. "Tell me, sister dear, what have you learned since you've been here?" Margaret told him how she became friendly with the sheriff and his wife. She handed him a sketch she'd made of the Telluride First National Bank's interior and a description of the employees. Her report included the arrival of the payroll shipment from the bank in Denver and the counting today before it was sent to the mines tomorrow. Cromwell looked at his watch. "We have one more hour before the bank closes. The best time to remove the currency and leave town."
"I spotted a man hanging around the railroad depot. I couldn't tell for sure, but I suspect he might have been a Van Dorn agent who was on the lookout for you."
Cromwell looked thoughtful. "Even if Van Dorn sends agents to watch train arrivals and departures during payroll shipments, they're only chasing a phantom. No way they could know where I'll strike next."
"If they're wise to your boxcar, it's a good thing you had it repainted."
She looked at him quizzically.
"Just how do you expect us to make a clean escape after you rob the bank?"
Cromwell grinned wolfishly. "Who would suspect a pair of clean-cut, attractive ladies riding slowly out of town in a horse and buggy?" She placed her arm around his shoulders.
"The simplest plan is the best plan. You are brilliant, brother. You never cease to amaze me.
I appreciate the compliment, he said, rising to his feet. We don't have much time. The payroll awaits.
What would you like me to do?
Go to the stable and pick up my horse and buggy. I told the stable owner my sister would come by to get the rig. Then wait at the back door of the bank.
While Irvine watched the train station and town rail yard, Bell and Curtis manned the Telluride Bank. Sitting in Murray Oxnard's office, Bell began to think he had bet on the wrong horse. There were only 10 minutes left before closing time and no sign of the bandit. Playing the role of a teller, Irvine was getting ready to close out his cash box in anticipation of waiting on the last customer. Bell glanced down at the .45 Colt automatic he'd kept in an open desk drawer and regretted that he would not get to use it on the butcher bandit. Blowing the scum's head off was too good for him, Bell mused. Not after he had murdered so many unsuspecting people. His death would save the taxpayers the expense of a trial. Now Bell was faced with admitting defeat and starting over again with the meager clues he and his agents had ferreted out. Irvine walked over to the office door and leaned his shoulder against the frame.
I can't deny it was a good try, he said with a tightness in his voice. It looks as if the bandit failed to take the bait, Bell said slowly. Perhaps he didn't read the article in the paper because he doesn't live in San Francisco. It's beginning to look that way.
Just then the door opened and a woman wearing a buckskin skirt walked into the bank, her hat pulled low so it covered her eyes. Bell gazed past Irvine but relaxed at seeing what appeared to be a well-dressed woman. He nodded to Irvine, who walked back to his teller's cage and said,
How may I help you, ma'am?
Cromwell lifted his head slightly so he could look into Irvine's face. Then, with a pang of alarm, he stiffened as he instantly remembered the Van Dorn agent as one of the men who were sitting with Bell and Bronson in the Bohemian Club dining room only days earlier. He did not answer Irvine for fear his voice would give him away to the agent. Cromwell became charged with tension as he realized this was a trap. There came a pause as he lowered his head, his mind racing with alternatives. His advantage was that the agent did not recognize him, not dressed as a woman, and was not alert to the fact that the bandit was less than 4 feet away on the other side of the counter. He could shoot the agent and take what money was in the safe, or he could simply turn around and walk out of the bank. He chose the latter option and was about to beat a hasty retreat when Bell stepped from the office. Cromwell immediately recognized Bell. For the first time in his criminal career, he felt the spur of panic.
How may I help you, ma'am? Irvine repeated, vaguely wondering why the woman did not answer him the first time.
Already, Bell was looking at him with a questioning expression on his face, as if the female customer looked familiar. Bell was a master of identification and had a photographic memory when it came to faces. His eyes betrayed the fact that he was trying to recall where he'd seen her. Then his eyes dropped to Cromwell's hands, which were covered by leather gloves. Abruptly, as if he had seen an apparition, he realized that he was staring at the bandit. It struck him like a hammer blow to the head. Bell's eyes flared open and he gasped,
You!
Cromwell did not waste another second. He reached into his large cloth purse and jerked out his .38 Colt, which had a heavy cloth taped around the muzzle. Without the slightest hesitation, he pointed the Colt at Irvine's chest and pulled the trigger. A loud thump reverberated in the bank's lobby. Then he swung the muzzle around and shot at Bell even before Irvine hit the floor like a rag doll. If Bell hadn't instinctively whirled around and thrown his body over the top of the desk, crashing to the floor behind it, the bullet would have caught him square in the stomach. The violent thrust saved him, but the bullet still plowed through the fleshy part of his thigh. He hardly felt the piercing blow.
In a single movement, he reached up and snatched his Colt from the desk drawer. Without the luxury of time, he snapped off a shot at Cromwell that missed the neck of the bandit by less than half an inch. Then, faster than lightning could strike, both men fired again, the shots coming so closely together they sounded as one. Cromwell's second bullet gouged a small trench across the side of Bell's head, barely piercing the skin but creasing the skull. Bell's vision became a blurred mist, and he fell into the black pit of unconsciousness. Blood quickly seeped from the wound and covered the side of his head. It had not been a decisive wound, but to Cromwell, who was still standing, it looked as if he had shot off half of Bell's head. The bandit did not come out of the gun battle unscathed. Bell's bullet had caught Cromwell in the waist, but had passed through without striking any internal organs. He swayed, and only by reaching out and grasping the edge of the teller's cage did he prevent himself from falling to the floor. He stood there for a few moments, fighting the pain. Then he turned and unlocked the rear door, standing aside as Margaret burst in.
"I heard shots outside," she shouted in shock. "What went wrong?"
"It was a trap," he murmured as anger replaced fear. Holding a hand over his wound, he motioned the muzzle of his Colt toward the office floor. "I killed Isaac Bell." Margaret stepped into the office and looked down at the bloodied Van Dorn agent, and a look of horror came into her eyes as she recognized Bell, despite the blood covering much of his face.
"Oh, my God."
She felt as if she was going to be sick, but the nausea quickly passed when she turned and saw that her brother was also bleeding.
"You're hurt," she gasped.
"Not as bad as it looks," he said through clenched teeth. "We've got to get out of here. The shots will bring the sheriff and rouse half the town." Margaret half-carried, half-dragged her wounded brother through the rear door of the bank. Outside, the horse and buggy were waiting. She used all her strength to push him onto the seat of the rig, untied the horse from the fence post, and climbed aboard. She raised the whip to urge the horse to a gallop, but he grabbed her wrist. "No, go slowly. As if we're two women out for a buggy ride. It will look suspicious if we charge out of town."
"The sheriff is a smart man. I know him. He won't fool easily."
"Even a smart man won't suspect a woman of robbing a bank and killing two men," muttered Cromwell. At the end of the alley, Margaret turned the buggy up a side street and then headed west toward the town limits. Cromwell took off the wolfskin coat and draped it over his lap to cover the blood that soaked his sweater. He slipped the Colt into one of his cowboy boots and sat back, trying to keep his mind clear by ignoring the throbbing pain in his side. Bell had instructed Sheriff Pardee that he would fire a shot as a signal if the bandit made his appearance. But Pardee knew there was trouble when he heard five shots, some of them muffled like the distant dynamite charge in a nearby mine. He rushed into the street from a hardware store where he had been hiding, fearful that the woman he'd seen walk into the bank might have been shot by the bandit. Seeing him running toward the bank, four of his deputies leaped from their hiding places and rushed after him, while a fifth deputy ran to the railroad depot to alert Curtis. With his single action Smith & Wesson drawn and the hammer pulled back, Pardee burst through the door of the bank. At first, he didn't see anyone. Irvine was lying out of sight behind the teller's cage, and Bell was down on the other side of the desk. Then he came around the cage, saw the Van Dorn agent sprawled on the floor in a pool of blood. He checked to make sure Irvine was dead before he entered the office and found Bell.
"Is he a goner?"
asked one of his deputies, a great bear of a man with a huge stomach bulging over pants with suspenders stretched to their limits, who stood poised with a sawed-off shotgun at the ready.
"The bullet only creased his skull," answered Pardee. "He's still alive." "What about the woman?"
Pardee's mind did not register for a moment. Then it hit him. "The woman who came into the bank before the gunshots?"
"That one."
She must have been abducted by the bandit. But we saw no one else enter the bank before or after her. Pardee stood up in confusion and disbelief. It took all his imagination to believe a woman was the butcher bandit. The bandit must have entered through the back door.
I don't know, Sheriff, said the deputy, scratching his chin. The door should have been locked from the inside like it always is.
Pardee rushed over to the rear door and found it unlocked. He jerked it open and peered up and down the alley but saw no one.
Hell's fire, he muttered. She got away.
She can't get far, said the deputy.
Round up the men, snapped Pardee.
He motioned to another deputy who was standing at the entrance of the bank. Get Doc Madison. Tell him the Van Dorn agent is down with a head wound and to get over to the bank double quick.
Pardee knelt down and quickly examined Bell again. Also tell him there looks like there's a bullet in the agent's leg.
The deputy was no sooner out the door than Pardee was on his heels, running toward his horse tied to the hitching post in front of his office. It didn't seem possible, he thought, that everything had gone so terribly wrong. Only then did it begin to strike him that the bandit was a man disguised as a woman, and that the poor widow he and his wife had taken in was an accomplice. As soon as they left the city limits of Telluride and passed the road leading to the mines of Ophir to the south, Margaret gave the horse the whip and urged it to run through the canyon and down the road heading west toward Montrose. During the 10 minutes since they left the bank, Cromwell had time to think. He pointed to a break in the trees that led to a bridge over the San Miguel River. It was an overgrown access road used by the railroad for maintenance crews repairing the track. Get off the road, Jacob said to Margaret. Go over the bridge and head down the track bed. She turned and looked at him. I thought you said they'd never be suspicious of two women in a buggy. That was before it occurred to me that the sheriff and his deputies were watching the bank. That goes without saying, but what does it have to do with our escape? Don't you see, dear sister? I was the last one to enter the bank and never came out. If what you say is true, Pardee is no fool. He must have put two and two together by now and is looking for both of us. But he'll never think to search for us riding over the track bed. He'll be certain we took the road.
And if he doesn't find us, what do you think he'll do then?
He'll backtrack, thinking that we hid out in the trees while he and his posse rode past. By then, we'll be on a train out of Montrose, dressed as two men. As usual, Cromwell was miles ahead of his pursuers when it came to matching wits. Though he was disheartened that Bell had outsmarted him in laying a well-conceived trap, he gained a certain amount of satisfaction believing he had killed the famous Van Dorn agent. Just as he had predicted, the sheriff and his posse charged down the road that was out of sight of the railroad tracks in the trees and, not finding any sign of their quarry, had doubled back toward Telluride. It was a bumpy ride over the railroad ties, but it was compensated for by knowing that Pardee had been hoodwinked and would end up empty-handed.